Welcome back, Creepaholics crew. I'm your host, Shanice, and this is our Halloween Spectacular in podcast form. We will have four stories to perform for you tonight. The first one is The Cleveland Strangler. Anthony Edward Solwell was born August 19, 1959, and died February 8, 2021. He was known as the American Serial Killer, or known as the Cleveland Strangler. He was a serial killer and a rapist. In his early days, he was born in East Cleveland, Ohio. He was one of seven children born to a single parent named Claudia Gertrude Garrison. There was also another seven children residing at the home as well. There were the children of Solwell's sister. The children moved in after Solwell's sister had died from a chronic illness. Solwell's niece, Leona Davis, claims Miss Garrison subjected them to physical abuse, while her own children was forced to watch the cruel actions she endured on them. In one incident, she claims Miss Garrison forced Davis to strip naked in front of the other children, then proceeded to whip her with an electrical cord until she bled. Solwell then began raping his niece on a daily basis for almost 2 years, and it started when she was 10. Davis said other males would enter the home as well and perform lewd acts to children in the home. On January 24, 1978, Solwell entered into the military. He attended recruitment training at Marine Corps Recruitment Depot on Paris Island, which is located in South Carolina. There, he resumed further training to be an electrician at Camp Louisian in North Carolina. It was on July 13, 1978, when he was assigned to the 2nd Marine Aircraft Wing at Marine Corps Air Station Cherry Point, also in North Carolina. In 1980, he spent a year overseas with a 3rd Air Force Service support group before returning to Cherry Point. Solwell would then move to Marine Corps Base Camp Butler in Okinawa Prefecture, Japan. And on January 20th, 1984, a year later, he was transferred to Camp Paddleton in California for 3 days, before discharge on January 18th, 1985. During 7 years of being in a Marine Corps career, he earned a Good Conduct Medal with 1 star, also a Sea Service Deployment Ribbon, a Certification of Commendation, a Meritorious Mass, and 2 letters of appreciation upon leaving the military. Then, in 1989, a series of attacks began on women. One woman, who was 3 months pregnant, attempted to leave Solwell's home, but he bound her hands and feet with a tie and belt and began to gag her with a rag. She did report this to police, stating, "He choked me really hard. Because my body started tingling, I thought I was going to die." They did charge him with kidnapping, rape, and attempted rape, and served 15 years in prison. Upon release in 2005, he began factory work until 2007. When he began collecting unemployment, neighbors reported he earned money by collecting scrap metal and most neighbors complained of a foul smell in the neighborhood. He was also a member of the online dating service. He claimed on his dating profiles that he was a master and looking for a submissive companion to train. He soon began a relationship with Lori Fraser. She claimed she smelled decaying bodies and a foul smell in Solwell's home. Solwell claimed it was his stepmother. After she moved out, the smell remained. Then he had claimed at one point that the smell was from Ray's sausage shop, which was just next door. She does say that she moved out in 2007, but in an article published, she claims that she lived there. It claims that she lived there until 2008. But a friend of Fraser claims she stopped spending time at Solwell's in 2008. That was not the time that she moved out. In September 2009, in Solwell's true actions would start to be unveiled. Solwell was inviting LaTondra Billups to his home for a drink. On September 22nd, she would proceed to tell police that after a few drinks with Solwell, he became angry and hit and started to choke her, then proceeded to rape her. As she passed out on October 29th, police would proceed to Solwell's residence with an arrest warrant, but he was not at the home. It would take 2 days to locate Solwell's whereabouts. Police then would find 2 bodies of women that were buried in shallow graves in the basement. Another 4 women would be found on the 3rd floor of the home and in the crawl space. Investigators began digging up the backyard where 3 more bodies would be discovered, and partial remains of a 4th. In the house also was found was a human skull inside a bucket, which would bring the body count to 11. Most victims were manually strangled and others were gagged or had ligature marks on their bodies when they were discovered. Sowell had also raped 3 women by luring them to his property with the intentions of smoking crack cocaine with him. At the time of his arrest, Sowell was 50 years old. He had been living at the residence for 4 years. He was held on a $5 million bounty. His trial was set on June 2nd, but was held on to be delayed until September 7th to give his attorney more time to prepare. Then, on February 14th, 2011, to May 2nd, at the request of his attorney, who needed more time to examine thousands of records and hours of surveillance video footage that was shot from the property adjacent to Sowell's house. Later on June 6th, at the request of the prosecution due to the scheduling conflicts of the trial, they would begin trial that day. November 5th, 2009, 2 of the 11 victims would be identified. All of Sowell's victims were identified and considered African-American women, either slender or morbidly obese, built, except for one mother. Ages would differ between 30s to late 40s. Sowell would be charged with 11 counts of aggravated murder, 74 counts of rape, kidnapping, tampering with evidence, and abuse of a corpse. He pled not guilty by reason of insanity, but later he would change it to simply not guilty. On July 22, 2011, he would be convicted of all but 2 counts, including the murders of 11 women whose bodies were found in the home in 2009. On August 10th, jurors recommended the death penalty. On August 12th, Judge Dick Ambrose upheld the jury's recommendations, and Sowell's victims would be identified, and Sowell would get the death penalty. All the victims, in order, would be number 1, Crystal Dozier, age 38, May 2007. Number 2, Tashauna Calver, age 31, June 2008. Number 3, LaShonda Long, age 25, August 2008. Number 4, Michelle Mason, age 45, October 2008. Number 5, Tonina Carmichael, age 53, November 2008. Number 6, Liam Yavati Smith, age 44, January 2009. Or sorry, that was Kim Yavate Smith. I apologize, my mistake. Nancy Cobbs, age 45, April 2009. Imelda Hunter, age 47, April 2009. Janice Webb, age 48, June 2009. Talicia Fortson, age 33, June 2009. And our last victim would be Diana Turner, age 48, September 2009. On September 4th, he would plead on death. He would be placed on death row and imprisoned at the Chilcathiel Correctional Institution. The following November, Sowell's lawyers Jeffrey F. Keller and Thomas Rain filed a notice of appeal with the Supreme Court of Ohio. Sowell's execution was set for October 29th, 2012, but that March, a motion for stay of execution was filed. The motion was granted in April, pending a final disposition of the appeal. In October, his new lawyers, Jeffrey M. Gamso and Erica Cunliffe, at the Cuyahoga County Public Defender's Office, appealed his conviction and death sentence overturned on 21 points, the 3 main being, point 1, that he did not receive a fair trial because of the extensive media coverage. The media had an overwhelming attention, which generated thousands of news stories and local coverage, which was both frenzied and sustained. Number 2, that the courtroom had been closed to the public during an evidentiary hearing and while a jury was picked. Number 3, the lousy lawyer he had as legal representation, Sowell's trial, and attorneys should have told their client to plead guilty to the killings of the women and focus their efforts on preventing Sowell from getting the death penalty. On September 14, 2016, the Ohio court asked both parties to address these issues. On April 5th, Supreme Court heard the arguments. Sowell's lawyer stated his Sixth Amendment was violated by closing the suppression hearing prior to the trial, and should change the death penalty to life imprisonment. On December 8, 2016, the Ohio Supreme Court rejected an appeal from Sowell's affirming lawyer, saying that his aggravated murders and convictions and death sentencing will hold in place. In May 2017, he appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, but in October, it would be chose that they do not want to hear him again. In February 2018, the Ohio Supreme Court denied his request again to reopen his appeal. In May 2020, the state of Ohio's 8th District Appellate Court denied his appeal, but attorney Sowell would eventually die in prison on February 8, 2021, of an unspecified terminal illness. On December 2011, which was the former residence of Anthony Sowell, at 12205 Imperial Avenue, was demolished by order of the city. The case was profiled on the series premiere of the investigation discovery show Killer Instinct. In 2012, Laura Paglen released a documentary called Unseen, which covers the victims and survivors of Anthony Sowell. So if you're interested in seeing what happened to the victims and where they are now, please go check out the Unseen documentary. It is a good one. I'm telling you, it has a lot of information and lets you know about what they are doing. So that was our first story for you on our Halloween special. And yes, I do know that this will not be released on Halloween due to editing errors, but we are here. We love it. We enjoy it. We continue our stories for you. So our second story up tonight will be Robert the Doll, and if you see my live video on YouTube, which we did the video live, I do have a old school Cabbage Patch doll, which I am dressed up as a dead police officer. So if you want to head over and check out all these stories, but in video form, please do so. It is that YouTube channel, Creepaholics. Now on to our second story, Robert the Doll. The story of Robert the Doll starts with his owner, Eugene Otto. Eugene lived in the Key West of Florida, which is known to be a very haunted area, with stories surrounding the Key West and wider state. But Robert the Doll is known all too well. It's said that the elements of Bahamian voodoo is what links the two together. Eugene got Robert from his grandfather while his grandfather was on a trip to Germany in 1904. He purchased the doll for Otto for his birthday. So when he received Otto as a birthday gift, he was delighted. Now, Robert may look nothing but a cornware doll dressed in a sailor suit holding a dog toy. He is covered in small marks that seem to appear like little scars. He has two small beady eyes with a smirk on his face. But mainly, everyone believes Robert is responsible for many fatal happenings, such as causing car accidents, relationship breakdowns, divorce, death, and disease, and much, much more. The home Eugene lived in was located at 534 Eaton Street. It was known as the Artist Home. It was built between 1890 to 1898. This is where the friendship began and forged a cryptic beyond. The strange things began to happen after Eugene received Robert. The first occurrence that proved something was wrong with the doll was one night. Eugene was in his bed, and he was 10 years old at the time, awoke to find Robert sitting at the end of his bed, staring at him. Moments later, Eugene's mom was awoken by screams for help and the sound of furniture being moved. In her son's bedroom, the mother attempted to open the door, but when she could finally wrench the door open, Eugene's room was in shambles. Eugene was curled up in fear on his bed with Robert sitting at the end of his bed, where he was when Eugene woke up. All Eugene could say is, "Robert did it." That was the only thing he could say when destructive things would happen. Eugene's parents would often hear their son talking upstairs to Robert the Doll, and getting a response back in a completely different voice. They repeated, Robert would speak and witness his expressions changing. Giggling was heard, and sights of Robert running up and down the steps would be seen upstairs as well. As passerbyers would go by the house, they would see Robert peering out the upstairs window at them. Strange, isn't it? A doll running upstairs, being seen, heard giggling, expressions changing. Some creepy stuff. Robert and Eugene continued to live together throughout his lifetime, and after Eugene's parents died, Eugene moved back into their home with his wife, Anne. Jean even gave Robert his own room with the viewing window of the front of the house. Robert loved to stare out of. Even though Eugene loved Robert, he made Anne feel very uneasy. Even though she could not put her finger on it, she wanted to lock Robert up. And in the attic, Robert would go, make sure he could do no harm to anyone. Eugene agreed, and of course, Robert was not happy. Some visitors would hear footsteps in the attic, like someone was running back and forth with devilish giggling. Children in the neighborhood would say they see Robert in the upstairs bedroom window, but Robert was locked in the attic. So when they would walk to school, they witnessed Robert sitting there. When Jean heard this, he immediately was running to the attic to go unlock it to investigate. But upon heading up there, Eugene was shocked to find Robert back in his chair in front of the window. He broke out of the locked attic. Robert was locked up several times and was found back in the same spot in the room. Eugene Otto died in 1974. He was known as an eccentric artist and a member of the Key West family. Robert the doll was actually named after his owner, Eugene. His name was Robert, but he preferred to go by Eugene. Just want to clarify that up, but I thought I'd throw that in there for you. After Eugene died, a 10-year-old girl and her family had moved into the house. She had found Robert in the attic of Eugene's former home. She was delighted to find him, but soon claimed Robert was alive, and he wanted to hurt her. She would wake up in the middle of the night screaming in fear as Robert would move around her room. In 1994, Robert would become the property of the museum in Key West, Florida. He is displayed in a UV-filtered glass to preserve the artifact with complete humidity control. But the museum still gets reports of evil attributes to the doll. Robert is 117 years old and still lives at the Fort East Martello Museum in Key West, Florida. The museum decided to do a bit more digging on Robert and see where his origins came from. He came from a stuffy company, which actually was the same toy maker that manufactured a teddy bear in honor of Theodore Roosevelt. Robert was most likely manufactured to be part of a fabric set for a window display of clowns and jesters. But his sailor suit did not come from the factory. Eugene was the one who most likely dressed him in it. Tons of visitors do visit Robert, but there are rules you must follow and respect Robert. Or you will have unexplained tragedies. Robert gets letters and emails daily from visitors who refused to listen when they went to visit Robert and ended up being haunted after leaving. Robert is the doll that you must apologize to if you disrespect. Robert the doll is one doll you do not want to mess with. He is a doll that will haunt you in your dreams, will come after you in your home, and can cause tragedy within your family. So if you go to visit Robert the doll, please respect his wishes and treat him with respect. Because if you don't, Robert the doll may come to get you. For our third story tonight, we have a short little clip. It's called The Woman in Black. In Appalachian folklore, a woman in black is a supernatural figure in the early mid-1900s. The woman would appear in various regions throughout the southern and western parts of the United States. A woman in black would typically appear to men who were misbehaving or cheating on their wives. Folklore states a legend that some towns such as Bristol, Virginia, Tazewell, Virginia, Lynchburg, Virginia, Richmond, Virginia, Jackson, and Minnesota all had reported sightings of the woman in black. In some occurrences, the woman in black would sometimes hit or pummel, or sometimes even knock the men to the ground, as they would say, by slapping him to earth with the swish of her phantom garments. She would do this as a retribution for their sins against the women they were supposed to be locked in wed with. So that was our short little clippet of Woman in Black. I know it's very short and probably wasn't worth to throw in here, but I wanted to kind of throw in something light before we got into something heavy. Our last story that we have for you tonight is one not to take too lightly.
I call it Paradise of Death, Arihano, the cannibal. Two German travelers set off to have a vacation together. Heike and her boyfriend Stefan Romani had sailed to the southwest of the Galapagos Islands. The boat had an alarm that would sound off when they got within 30 nautical miles, but it never sounded upon passage. So after being at sea for 17 days, Stefan heard his girlfriend, Heike, yell, "Over there, land!" It was on an island called Fatua Hawaii that she spotted over the ocean view. It was in the Marquesas Islands of the French Polynesian Sea. Heike claims it was like a Peter Jackson cinematic hallucination. The day was August 30th, 2011. The island's palm-fronted coast, basalt spires in the sunlight, partially shrouded in the mist, seemed to climb thousands of feet in the sky. Heike thought her and Stefan had found paradise. Little did they know, it was far from it. Stefan had taken a selfie of him and Heike when they first arrived, both smiling side by side with their son, bleached hair. Heike, 37, looked serene in a wind-ruffled white top. Stefan, 40, was wearing a red shirt and had a rugged, muscular build. He was a heavy, blocked jaw face, and in the background was their boat and the island's landscape. They would decide to stay for 6 weeks, twice as long as they had originally planned. They found a trail when they first arrived on the island at the edge of the beach. They followed it west for about 15 minutes until they came across about a half a dozen houses with pastel-colored plywood, as walls, metal roofs, and windows covered with curtains. It looked deserted, but Stefan spotted a man in the distance. He was built like a football player. He had tattoos. He was more than 6 feet tall, but so were most of the men that lived in the Marquesas Islands. So they thought this was normal native, but looks can be deceiving. Heike said they met so many new people on the trip and experienced very multilingual travelers. I can't say that word. Apologize. They were used to new experiences and people. But by inviting themselves into strangers' lives, they also exposed their safety and could fall into danger at any moment. The Marquesas Islands had a very complicated history with newcomers and believed them to be superficial. As the two began walking towards this man that was standing by a horse, he would be the man that would show them the paradise. But this wasn't paradise. Heike claims the man would turn our circumnavigation into a nightmare. That's exactly what she quoted, but I'm sorry I cannot pronounce that word for the life of me. As they approached, she smiled and greeted the man. Now, they weren't the first newcomers that would have washed up on the islands of the French Polynesian. It was noted to be a paradise that was invented by the widely read accounts of the 18th century European explorers that depicted these islands to be lavish paradises that would perpetually give you happiness and that every person would search for. Even Survivor was shot on the island of Nikua, Hawaii. They shot season 4 there. But most people think it's just a paradise, but no one really looks behind the scenes of the paradise for what it really is. The Marquesan Island warriors are actually feared for being the most ruthless and ravenous cannibals in the South Pacific. Historians believe it was most likely a rare form of ceremonial human sacrifice that did happen, but they believed it had died out in the 20th century. Even though the couple knew about these dangers, but never believed they would encounter such tragedies. After they arrived, Stefan actually signed into Facebook to check in upon arriving the island. So in the Facebook check-in point, you can put your location in, and that's what Stefan did. So at least they knew where, at least everyone knew where their location was. Now, the day after they met this man, his name was Arihano Hati, 31-year-old man. They saw him again in the village. It was around noon on October 9th, 2011. The couple was just returning from a long hike to the Vapio waterfall, which plunged more than 1,100 feet from the steep side of the Hakui Valley. The couple planned to sail off the next morning, but Stefan had one more final activity planned. He hired Arihano to take him on a goat hunt, but Hakui does not recall Stefan asking, or does recall Stefan asking if he should bring a gun. But Arihano would say no, that wouldn't be necessary. Now, Stefan wanted to bring this gun from his boat because he figured he's going hunting, he needed to protect himself. But he did not take it with him, for reasons that are unknown. Even though he got told not to, I would have brought it. A couple hours passed. Arihano and Stefan would set off to go on this goat hunt. Haiki watched them, the two men, as they walked into the jungle. She watched as their backpacks bobbed and their shoulders as they walked, disappearing into the tree line. Even though Stefan and his girlfriend had taken 4 hours hike that morning, he wasn't one to tire easy. He was carelessly energetic and would never pass up an opportunity for an adventure. This was Stefan's third attempt to try and go goat hunting. So now that he had the chance, he was not going to pass this up. It had been on his bucket list. As Haki hung back and sipped on her coffee, one of Stefan's favorite expressions would come across her mind, not knowing the fate of Stefan had fallen into. Stefan Sklosh de Wan de Totbish, which translates to "you can sleep when you're dead." After hours had passed, Haki says around 6 p.m., she heard a voice from the darkness just beyond Baju, which was the name of their boat. She says it was Arihano, but he was in a dinghy, all alone. Where was Stefan? Communication was difficult between the two because Arihano only spoke French and snippets of English. Now, she was fluent in English, but she only knew a little bit of French. She asked, "Where is Stefan?" And Arihano would reply, "Injured, accident, forest." She was worried, immediately jumps into the dinghy, not thinking, and she says when Arihano reached the beach, he would rush into the forest and she would follow. As she followed, they would walk in complete silence. She started to become more frantic at about 15 minutes into the trail. And then it started to peter out into an open area. She asked, "Where is Stefan?" Arihano would reply with, "I don't remember where I put him." She exploded with rage. "You don't remember? You idiot! How could you do that? How could that be?" She would tell Arihano that she would go and get help. She turned and proceeded back down the trail and yelling Stefan's name. "Stefan! Stefan! Over here!" And over, again and again. After several minutes, she would come to a stop. Standing there, scared, she felt a presence behind her. Arihano would then show and point a gun behind her head and say, "You die now." She yelled, and no. And with the two began wrestling with this gun, he attempted to, well, let's just say he didn't let her off so easy. He attempted to choke her, and at the moment of giving her a breath, she noticed that he was trying to rape her and was orgasming on top of her by rubbing up against her. He would then drink some water, proceed to tie her up, gag her, and began walking her to the beach for reasons unknown. She managed to loosen her ropes as they walked, and her first chance, she ran through those woods as she could, as fast as she could, getting hit by branches, getting cut, scars, broken twigs under her feet. Then she came to the water. She had to make the decision of what to do next. Should she take the chance to swim towards the boat? Then she remembered that afternoon, she had seen a boat dock there in the vicinity. She was worried that the cuts from running through the trees would attract the sharks, but she had no choice. Then she heard a familiar voice calling her name. It was one of her friends. She had managed to run out of the forest to where her friend was aboard another boat and docked close by. By the time she climbed aboard and began to explain what had happened, two hours later, the military police would arrive by satellite phone call. They searched the jungle all night looking for Arihondo or Safon. The next day, which was Wednesday, Haki was summoned to the Gendarmerie in Tahoe, which was the main village in Nuki Hava. They would tell her they found a massive fire pit and inside was the skeleton remains, which they believed was Safon. After 7 weeks on the run, Arihondo would actually turn himself in because he claims he saw no future as a fugitive. He admits to killing Safon, but claims a different story. He claims he shot Safon in self-defense because he was attempting to rape him. After killing him, he claims that he wanted to rape Stefan's girlfriend. But there is no evidence that Safon ever tried to rape Arihondo or what had actually suffered, like what fates Safon had actually suffered. They only found his remains burned. So any evidence or anything that could be proven was just completely charred by Arihondo. Now, attorneys of Arihondo would then proceed to try to get, like, the actual events of what happened, but Arihondo would still repeat to say Safon tried to rape him. But in the end, Arihondo would be charged with killing Safon and get 3-decade life sentences with no parole. Now, most people around this story claim that Arihondo is one of the ritualistic cannibals that live on the island and decided to take Safon in and sacrifice him and eat his flesh. But again, we cannot prove this. There's no proof. There's nothing, but he said, she said, and of course we know that Safon was attacked and we know that she was attacked. That is true, but we don't know what Arihondo's true intentions were that night with Safon. But sadly, that was our story of Paradise of Death. So anyone who's traveling to anywhere that they're going, please research, do some history, find out where you're going, find out if there's things you should be worried about. There's always things you should be worried about, but things you should be looking for, you know, specific things, because it could save your life one day. Thank you to everybody who has tuned in to this wonderful Halloween spectacular. I hope you enjoyed my content for you tonight. As I know, it wasn't that long of a spectacular episode, but I guarantee you next week's podcast is going to be one you're not going to want to miss. So without further ado, do not forget to check out our YouTube channel, like I mentioned in the beginning, where we have our Halloween spectacular in video format. I am also on 9 different podcast platforms. I also have a Patreon page if you feel like you want to just donate or share some loves to your local creepaholics. We also have some merchandise and some stickers if you want to check that out, but honestly, you don't need to. I am so happy with just having you listen to my content. Thank you to everybody who has tuned in for our Halloween special, and I bid you a good night. Keep creeping it real.
Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now. Ha 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 ha.